Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Oxford Handbook of IPOs, edited by Douglas Cumming and Sophia A. Johan, read by Mike Chamberlain. Chapter 1. Introduction. Douglas Cumming and Sophia A. Johan. Firms begin as privately owned entities. When they grow large enough, the decision to go public and its consequences are among the most crucial times in a firm's life cycle. The first time a firm becomes a public reporting issuer gives rise to tremendous responsibilities about disclosing public information and accountability to a wide array of retail shareholders and institutional investors. Initial public offerings, IPOs, offer tremendous opportunities to raise capital. Over 1980 to 2014, firms in the United States raised $805.77 billion in capital from IPOs, and in 2001 to 2014, firms raised $396.15 billion. Some IPOs in recent years have been quite successful, such as Alibaba, while others, such as Facebook, have been associated with less success and even lawsuits. The worldwide landscape for IPOs has significantly evolved over the last few decades. In 2015, Hong Kong was the largest IPO market in the world. Deutsch and others, 2017, show that the number of listed firms in the United States fell from 8,025 in 1996 to 4,101 in 2012, while non-U.S. listings increased from 30,734 to 29,427 over the same period. And unusual differences exist even among neighbor countries. For example, in 2012, despite having roughly 10% of the population of the United States, Canada had 3,673 listed companies, or 90% the number of listed companies in the United States. Clearly, there has been a global shift in where companies list, and part of that explanation comes from regulation of the IPO market, as documented in this handbook. The economic and legal landscape for IPOs has been rapidly evolving across countries. There have been scant IPOs in the United States in the aftermath of the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis and associated regulatory reforms that began in 2002. In 1980 to 2000, an average of 310 firms went public every year, while in 2001 to 2014, an average of 110 firms went public every year. At the same time, there are so many firms that seek an IPO in China that there has been a massive waiting list of hundreds of firms in recent years. Some countries are promoting small junior stock exchanges to go public early, and even crowdfunding to avoid any prospectus disclosure. Financial regulation over analysts and investment banks has been evolving in ways that drastically impact the economics of going public, with some countries, such as the United States, drastically increasing the minimum size of a company before it is expected to go public. This handbook systematically and comprehensively consolidates a large body of literature on IPOs and provides a foundation for future debates and inquiry. This handbook studies the international landscape of IPOs in the aftermath of the financial crisis. Moreover, it provides studies of special types of IPOs, such as special purpose acquisition companies, SPACs, and reverse mergers. It further shows alternatives to IPOs, including mergers and acquisitions, private marketplaces, and crowdfunding. There is a body of quality work on IPOs, but the literature is fragmented, including work in economics, finance, management, international business, and law. This handbook combines work from different scholars in these areas from around the world. IPOs and related topics of securities regulation, including investment banks, auditors, reverse mergers, venture capital, and crowdfunding, have been of significant interest in the recent literature. Evidence on the importance and growth of these topics is noted in studies. The data indicate that crowdfunding is one of the fastest-growing topics of academic interest. There is strong evidence of continued research on these topics in coming years. 1.1. Chapters in the Oxford Handbook of IPOs. The chapters are organized into five main parts. Part 1 deals with the economics of IPOs and offers statistics and regulatory insights from the United States and other countries around the world. Part 2 covers mergers versus IPOs, as well as reverse mergers and special purpose acquisition companies. Part 3 analyzes institutional ties in IPOs, including analysts, investment banks, auditors, and venture capitalists. Part 4 provides international perspectives on IPOs from Canada, Europe, Hong Kong, China, India, and New Zealand. Part 5 discusses alternatives to IPOs, including private marketplaces and crowdfunding. More specifically, Part 1 of this handbook begins in Chapter 2 with Keston's analysis of why companies seek to raise capital in an IPO. Chapter 3 by Bow and Dunbar examines the regulatory burdens associated with listing in the United States and the economic consequences for the number of listings over time. Chapter 4 by Bolton, Smart, and Zutter, 2017, examines the international IPO market in 38 countries and factors correlated with the extent to which IPOs are underpriced in different countries. Chapter 5 by Bhagat, Liu, and Rangan provides an analysis of the factors that affect IPO valuation in Australia, Canada, China, Germany, India, Japan, the United Kingdom, and United States. In Chapter 6, Jones and Yeoman provide an explanation as to why IPOs are underpriced in both hot and cold markets. Part 1 concludes with Wang and Young's Chapter 7 on IPO long-run returns, volume, and delisting. Part 2 of this handbook begins with an analysis of mergers versus acquisitions in Chapter 8 by Aktas, Andres, and Ozdekak. Thereafter, reverse mergers are studied in the United States by Sekela and Floros in Chapter 9, and in China by Cheng, Fleming, and Liu in Chapter 10. Shakhmurov and Vulanovic study special-purpose acquisition companies in Chapter 11. These alternative listing forms provide interesting insights into complements and substitutes to the IPO market and are growing in importance over time. Part 3 of this handbook examines the role of different institutional ties in IPOs, including the role of analysts in Chapter 12 by Buzwita and Gress, auditors in Chapter 13 by Koning, Mertens, and Rusenboom, underwriters in Chapter 14 by De Reaper and Schweinbacher, and venture capitalists by Haas and Tarasaluska, Chapter 15, and Shaheen, Filatochev, Hoskison, and Arthurs, Chapter 16. The final chapter in Part 3 by Lee, Yao, Chapter 17, measures the differential benefits of alternative types of institutional ties in IPOs. Part 4 of this handbook provides international perspectives on IPOs. Chapter 18 by Pendis and Robinson studies the Canadian IPO marketplace and special programs of capital pools. Chapter 19 by Bertoni, Mioli, and Vismara examines the importance of corporate governance in European IPOs. Jiao, Rusenboom, and Giudici study the survival of European IPOs in connection with low listing standards on these markets in Chapter 20. IPOs are empirically examined in chapters 21, 22, and 23 by Oler, Herberger, and Horn, Germany, Dong and Gu, China, and Dong and Jolly, New Zealand, respectively. Regulatory and institutional perspectives on IPOs are discussed in Chapter 24 by Lai for Hong Kong, in Chapter 25 by Young for New York, London, Hong Kong, and Singapore, and in Chapter 26 by Chakrabarty for India. Part 5 of this handbook concludes with alternatives to IPOs. Specifically, Chapter 27 by Adhami, Gianfrate, and Soda discuss private marketplaces and provides interesting examples of such marketplaces in the United States. It is surprising that these marketplaces have not received as much academic attention. Chapters 28 and 29 by Horvatova and Majumdar, respectively, discuss crowdfunding and international differences in regulation in the United States and Europe, Chapter 28, and regulatory arbitrage across countries, Chapter 29. There is a growing concern about the appropriate level and design of crowdfunding regulation, despite the fact that fraud rates are not as high as that in IPO markets in many countries around the world. 1.2. Conclusion. Overall, the evidence in this handbook points to the growing importance of research on IPOs, new forms of IPOs, including reverse mergers and special-purpose acquisition companies, and alternatives to IPOs, including private marketplaces and crowdfunding. These developments in new forms of IPOs and the developments in the new international landscape of IPOs around the world show the massive importance of securities regulation. Regulation has significant potential to improve surveillance and corporate governance and to mitigate the frequency and severity of fraud. New developments, including but not limited to crowdfunding, offer new research contexts and insights into the economics of new listings around the world. We hope that the chapters in this handbook inspire many more papers on the topic over the coming years. Part 1. The Economics and Regulation of IPO Markets. Chapter 2. The Law and Economics of the Going Public Decision. J. Keston. An initial public offering, IPO, is one of the most important events in the life cycle of a developing firm. The decision to go public, however, is complicated by the persistently cyclical market for public offerings. This chapter analyzes the macroeconomic determinants of IPO market cyclicality alongside the strategic and corporate governance considerations faced by private firms arising from the costs and benefits of going public. The law and economics of the going public decision are also relevant to the secular decline in IPOs since the turn of the millennium. This chapter evaluates several competing and complementary hypotheses that attempt to explain this phenomenon, each of which relies at least in part on the various features of the going public decision-making process. 2.1. Introduction. Going public is one of the most important decisions in the life cycle of a successful developing company, and the market for IPOs, in turn, affects various aspects of the domestic economy. Because IPOs involve both costs and benefits, firms must make a threshold determination concerning whether to go public or stay private. All else being equal, the aim is relatively straightforward. Maximize an objective function composed of the IPO proceeds, the expected value of future proceeds, plus any private benefits inuring to the firm's insiders. But that calculus is complicated by the fact that IPO pricing, typically the most significant variable in that objective function, is not exclusively determined by firm quality. Rather, The market for IPOs is persistently cyclical. Hot phases with a high volume of IPO activity and relatively high valuations alternate with cold phases, in which both the frequency of IPOs and their relative valuations plummet. There are, therefore, significant strategic considerations related to timing the going public decision alongside the threshold cost-benefit inquiry. Moreover, some firms do not have an indefinite real option to stay private. There may be additional factors, such as the presence of venture capitalists, VCs, with constrained investment time horizons or acute intra-firm capital needs that modify firms' strategic decision-making. The dynamics of the IPO market are also thought to impact various macroeconomic conditions. For example, the vibrancy of IPO activity is closely related to the availability of VC funding. VC funding, in turn, impacts the pace of innovation and entrepreneurship, employment growth, and potentially gross domestic product, GDP. It is therefore with some alarm that observers have documented a secular decline in IPOs in the United States since the turn of the millennium. The causes of this sustained trend are not yet fully understood, but an emerging literature posits several hypotheses that bear on firms' going public decision-making process. This chapter analyzes the law and economics of the going public decision both through the lens of strategic choices in a persistently cyclical market and as a function of the secular decrease in IPO exits. The chapter is organized as follows. Section 2.2 briefly surveys the main benefits and costs of an IPO to frame the subsequent discussion. Section 2.3 analyzes the key determinants of IPO cycling, business conditions, investor sentiment, adverse select costs arising from asymmetric information, and political uncertainty, and their impact on both inter- and intra-cyclical going public strategy. Section 2.3 then considers financial and corporate governance variables that can alter all else equal optimal market timing. Section 2.4 evaluates the going public decision in the context of competing theories explaining the secular decline in IPOs, regulatory overreach, the increasing value of economies of scope, and institutional investors' reduced demand for small-cap IPO shares. Section 2.4 also proposes another potential explanation, the rise of shareholder activism, which has been largely overlooked in the academic literature to date. Section 2.5 concludes by highlighting policy implications and possible paths of future research. 2.2. The benefits and costs of an IPO. A voluminous literature details the potential benefits of going public. These benefits fall primarily within three categories: the proceeds of the offering, the expected value of future benefits to the firm, and the private benefits of the offering to insiders. Perhaps most important, access to public equity markets allows firms to raise substantial capital at a cost that better approximates fair market value. Contemporaneously, the IPO provides a valuable exit event for early-stage equity investors, such as VCs. Indeed, IPOs are typically viewed as the best possible outcome for VCs, and, at least historically, they generate substantially higher returns on average than other forms of exit. For example, from 1985 to 2008, the mean and median company-level returns from IPO exits were 209.5% and 108.8%, compared with 99.5% and negative 32.1% for mergers and acquisitions, M&A exits. While the most valuable M&A exits compare favorably to the most valuable IPOs, M&A exits are much more likely to fall within the lowest quintile of returns and account for a disproportionate share of cases where the VC fails to recover the full amount of capital invested in the portfolio firm. IPOs also generate several second-order benefits for the firm. The creation of a liquid market in the firm's securities allows the firm to more easily use its shares as incentive compensation and consideration for acquisitions. Going public may also enhance the firm's reputation and visibility in the product market and can improve the firm's bargaining power with bankers or other creditors and thereby lower the future cost of capital. Finally, insiders, such as the firm's founders, obtain private benefits from going public. The creation of a liquid market for the firm's shares allows founders to diversify their own personal holdings. Also, many IPOs allow founders to regain control over their firms. In VC-backed startups, founders typically relinquish a variety of control rights contractually in exchange for venture funding. Going public generally extinguishes these contractual terms and returns control to founders after the VC's exit. Founders can take full control of the newly public firm by retaining a majority voting stake or by employing a dual-class, high-vote, low-vote share structure. And even in widely held firms, they can exert de facto control given the combination of their significant, albeit minority, stockholding, directorships, and top managerial positions. In either case, founders obtain the private benefits of controlling a publicly traded firm, which are generally considered quite significant. Thus, entrepreneurs largely prefer IPOs over M&A exits, in which they are more likely to lose their control rights and managerial influence. Surveys of corporate executives, conducted both before and after the internet bubble, shed light on the relative importance of these theorized benefits. In the United States, these executives report that funding for growth and the ability to use the firm's stock for M&A activity are the most important factors in the going public decision. Boosted firm reputation, the availability of an exit event, lowered cost of capital, and stock liquidity each enjoy moderate support in the aggregate, but may be more important for certain types of firms. For example, younger, venture-backed, and high-technology firms are more likely to view reputation enhancement as an important strategy component of the going public decision. Finally, corporate executives claim that the prospect of increased bargaining power vis-a-vis potential lenders and heightened external monitoring are relatively unimportant to many firms. But going public entails meaningful costs as well. There are non-trivial transaction costs associated with the IPO itself. For example, legal, underwriting, and other advisory fees. Then, once public, the firm takes on mandatory reporting obligations to regulators and investors. There are direct costs associated with preparing these disclosures, as well as indirect costs of revealing proprietary information to competitors. Public firms also become potential takeover targets in the market for corporate control and expose themselves to increased litigation risk in the form of securities class actions and breach of fiduciary duty claims. Corporate executives report that exposing their firm to the scrutiny of public markets is one of the most significant costs of going public. Thus, private firms face a threshold cost-benefit analysis in advance of an IPO, in which the firm attempts to maximize an objective function that can be approximated as IPO proceeds plus present value of future proceeds and benefits to the firm plus private benefits to insiders. Assuming that expected benefits exceed anticipated costs, the company must decide when to conduct its IPO. All else being equal, the objective is straightforward. Maximize the benefits of the IPO by raising the greatest amount of capital relative to the percentage of the firm's equity sold. But this decision is complicated by the fact that pricing is not exclusively a function of firm quality. The going public decision must be made strategically due to the cyclicality of the IPO market. Indeed, corporate executives view market conditions as a key determinant of whether and when to go public. 2.3. IPO cycles and the going public decision. The market for IPOs is persistently and dramatically cyclical. Hot markets, characterized by increased IPO volume, heightened valuations, and severe underpricing, the difference between the offering price and the closing price on the first day of trading in the secondary market, are followed by cold periods in which the number of IPOs plummets, valuations are less attractive, and underpricing is less pronounced. Four major determinants of IPO cycles emerge from the current literature: changing economic business conditions, investor sentiment, adverse selection caused by asymmetry of information between insiders and public investors, and the impact of political uncertainty. These hypotheses are by no means mutually exclusive. Many of the same forces that drive demand for equity capital also motivate investors to supply such funds. As such, multiple determinants might be mutually reinforcing and can thereby prolong either hot or cold market cycles. This section evaluates each of these hypotheses standing alone and considers the resultant inter- and intra-cyclical strategic behavior relative to the going public decision. The section then turns to financial, contractual, and corporate governance considerations that can alter this decision-making process. 2.3.1. Determinants of IPO cycles. The business conditions hypothesis is the most intuitive and well-established determinant of IPO cycles. Put simply, the business conditions hypothesis asserts that the frequency of IPOs depends on current conditions in the economy, and thus will be positively correlated with various measures of business activity, such as the prevailing cost of capital, expected profitability, and changes in uncertainty about the profitability of IPO firms. Early models of the business conditions hypothesis pertain to firms' financing choices more generally. For example, Lowry, 2003, posits that IPO volume is driven by private firms' aggregate demand for capital. When economic conditions are favorable, companies tend to seek more financing with which to capture their portion of that expected growth. In her model, IPOs are one method among many of obtaining such financing. More recently, Pastor and Veronesi, 2005, develop a model specific to the going public decision in which IPO volume fluctuates based on three economic conditions: expected market return, expected aggregate profitability, and prior uncertainty about post-IPO average profitability in excess of market profitability. In their model, private firms face trade-offs between current positive net present value projects that require a capital influx and the time value associated with a real option to go public in the future. If market conditions remain constant, it would be optimal to go public as soon as possible to begin production. If conditions vary over time, however, rational firms might delay an IPO in anticipation of more favorable conditions. In the Pastor and Veronesi 2005 model, going public is particularly attractive when expected market return is low expected aggregate profitability is high, and prior uncertainty is high.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?